Citizen Sounds, a diverse collection of sounds and stories from our researchers, educators, and students, sharing knowledge and insight to make a difference in Leicester and the world. We are Citizens of Change, University of Leicester. I'm Tree King, Professor of Public Engagement at the University of Leicester, and today I'm talking to Anna Hansel, who is Professor of Environmental Epidemiology and Director of the Centre for Environmental Health and Sustainability here at the University of Leicester. We'll be talking about Anna's various research projects around the impacts on our health of environmental noise and air pollution. But first of all, Anna, tell me about your background. You originally started in medicine before moving into public health, didn't you? So tell me about that.
Yes, I started off in hospital medicine. So I worked for 6 years working towards specialising in respiratory medicine. And I was the medical registrar. I was the person who was leading the crash calls, you know, running around. This is when people have a cardiac arrest in hospital. And we always got very busy on call because people would come in with problems with their asthma or their chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, really busy time. And I found that I felt I was at the very end of a long process in people's lives. And I wanted to get to somewhere earlier in their lives that I could intervene and stop them becoming ill or try and make their disease less severe. So I moved into public health training, and from there I did a PhD in epidemiology at Imperial College in London. And I was looking at long-term effects of air pollution on COPD, and also looked at diet. We looked at supermarket sales of fruit and vegetables and tried to see if that was related to COPD rates in districts in England.
So tell me about COPD. What is it? It's a disease. How does it manifest itself? What do we know about it?
Well, it's a disease that causes you to lose lung function. So there's different symptoms that you can get with it, but it's usually getting increasingly short of breath. And as it's often associated with bringing up mucus or phlegm from the chest. And if you do measurements of the lung, you find that there's a loss of the lung volume and the lung functionality. And things like smoking, we know smoking is a big risk factor for it, but there are a lot of people who develop COPD who are not smokers or who gave up smoking earlier in life. So smoking is just one of the risk factors. And we know there are some risks with particular occupations. So if you're working with dust or metal fumes, that can give you an increased risk of developing COPD. I think what's really of concern, though, is that there are people who don't have those risk factors and they still develop COPD. And also that there may be factors that the people who have COPD, it's worse than it needs to be because of some of the environmental exposures.
So is it something that's very common among the population?
It's the third most common cause of death. There's probably about 5%, 10% of the population who have some sort of limitation of their lung function by the time they get to over 55.
So your work has moved from something, you know, being a medic, so from something that's quite quick where you can treat somebody for a chest infection to research that's got quite a long lifespan. And you're working at the forefront of a really important area, so this impact of air pollution on our health. And I know many people will have heard of the case of Ella Adu-Kizzi-Debra, who lived near the South Circular Road in southeast London, and she died in 2013. And the inquest found that air pollution made a material contribution to her death. So this is really serious stuff. You've done some really interesting work around this, looking at historical data, haven't you?
I mean, that story is incredibly sad. So Ella had a very severe form of asthma and was obviously very sensitive to the effects of air pollution. That's obviously of concern for people at the severe end, but there's a whole sort of spectrum of people that might be affected by air pollution. So where air pollution is a risk factor that adds to the other risk factors in their life. So it's not just a question of, you know, air pollution affecting people who have very severe disease, but it can affect people who've got more mild disease and perhaps make it a bit worse than it could be. So in terms of long-term exposure, I've always been very interested about thinking about people's lifetime exposure. So some of the studies that are called long-term, they look at 5 years exposure maybe, and you sort of think, well, what happened? Because we know, you know, if you think about the 50s and 60s, the air pollution was really bad. We had those big smogs in London. The air pollution's been falling over time. But the question is, could that be having long-term effects on people's bodies? So what we did, and it took several years to do this, was to go back in time and estimate the air pollution exposures going back to 1962. We were able to do because the UK has very good data going back to the 1960s, and we were able to look at sort of soot particles, black smoke particles in the air, and sulfur dioxide, which is sort of acid in the air, and relate those to where people were living. So we had we also have the benefit in the UK of very long-running cohorts. So these are follow-up health studies. And I think it's somewhere between 3 and 5% of people in the UK are enrolled in these health studies overall. And we had some great data from the Office for National Statistics. So the census is held every 10 years. So in 1971, 81, 91 and 2001, we were able to look at a sample. I think it was about 360,000 people that we followed up over that period of time. We knew what their address was, and we could link it to the air pollution levels at that time, and then see if they died, and if they died, what did they die of? And we found that we could still see an effect of the air pollution in 1971 on the mortality risk up to 38 years later, which was as long as we followed them up for. And it was slightly larger for respiratory disease than for all-cause mortality. And the other really interesting thing we found in the study was that the air pollution people were exposed to in the most recent decade seemed to have a bigger influence on their mortality risk. And that's also quite interesting because it suggests that what you're exposed to a long time ago can have a long-lasting influence, but it wanes over time. And what you're exposed to more recently could be having a larger effect. So that would sort of fit biologically with what you might think is plausible biologically. But it also has quite important public health implications, because it means you can't just say, oh, well, you know, there's no point cutting air pollution now because it's having long-term effects. And the answer is, yes, you can cut it now. And you'd expect to see an improvement in people's mortality risks from cutting the air pollution now, as well as also having these longer-term benefits.
So I know that for some of the work that you've been doing was that you were showing that it's not just, you know, people who are alive and they are affected by this air pollution, but it's even affecting us in the womb. You did a really interesting study looking at birth weight around this, didn't you?
Yeah, so we made use of one of these wonderful long-term follow-up studies in the UK. So in the 1990s, mothers-to-be in the Bristol area were all enrolled into a cohort study and followed up, and their children were followed up for many years. They're still being followed up now. I worked with a colleague, John Gulliver, who's now a professor at Leicester, to look at the air pollution that these mothers were exposed to, and then their children were exposed to from early life. And one of the first things we looked at was, did it affect birth weight? So there's a number of studies now that are suggesting there may be an impact of exposure, particularly to particulates, which are these sort of fine particles of soot and dust in the air, and birth weight. And our study was particularly important because we were very careful about tracing where people lived during their pregnancy, which other studies have not been able to. So, you know, a lot of women do end up moving, or they move to the suburbs during pregnancy, and they might reduce their air pollution exposure. So we took that into account. But even taking that into account, we could see this very clear link between the air pollution levels and birth weight. And we saw a higher effect on the proportion of the particulate air pollution that was coming from traffic sources. We were trying to find out if there was a specific time in pregnancy that women were more sensitive. And the results were not conclusive on that. They possibly suggested that there's a slightly larger effect in the later period of pregnancy. The thing to reassure women is that the effect's not very large on this. You can see it because you look across a whole population. So it's obviously something that you're concerned about, and you don't want to have this adverse effect on babies. But I think for an individual, it's not something that we can say that is going to lead to disease in later life. It's a small impact, but it's something that we're concerned about as a public health, in terms of public health.
I think one of the things that's really coming across already in talking to you is just how important it is that you have people who are taking part in these studies. It allows you to do these really big studies.
The great bit is that these children have been coming back every 10 years or so and having various measures and blood tests taken. So we've been able to use some of those data to look at their lung function. So we looked at what they were exposed to in pregnancy and early years of life, and related to that to how their lung function was at age 8 and age 15. And we could see what you were exposed to in pregnancy and early life, first year of life, did seem to have an association with your lung function at age 8, but not by age 15. And we're not sure what the reason for that is, but we think a possibility is that air pollution's been declining over time, and these children may have been able to catch up the growth, during the adolescence period, which is a time of sort of rapid growth, and they may have been able to overcome these smaller effects of air pollution in early life. And we're now using that data set to go on and look at other outcomes. So I've got two PhD students. One of them's looking at air pollution and also hopefully noise to look at cardiovascular disease or cardiovascular development in children. And another one who's looking at cognitive function in children and autism to see if there might be a relationship with the environmental exposures.
So speaking about these large studies involving lots of people, I know you also helped develop this UK Biobank study that's been looking at lung function, didn't you? So first of all, tell us what the UK Biobank is and what have you been doing?
I have a very long association with that study. Starting in 2004, when I helped work on the protocol for the study and the pilot studies. And this is a huge study. It's 500,000 people. Aged 40 to 70 at enrolment, which was in 2005 to 2010, and it was set up to be able to examine genetic factors in common disease and also to be able to look at environmental factors. So it was a huge effort. I mean, it's had input from some of the best scientists, health scientists around the country over long periods of time. You know, there are people all over the world who are now using that study to get information about risk factors for health. I think it's around about 2012 or so. So it's a couple of years after the study's recruited. I was then overseeing the team who put in the air pollution data, or the initial air pollution data, into UK Biobank. And then a few years later, I had a PhD student who did various analyses, and we did some really nice analyses looking at the associations between those air pollution factors and chronic bronchitis symptoms. We looked at lung function, we looked at COPD, we looked at wheeze, shortness of breath, asthma. The lung function results were the most interesting to me, because we could link what people were being exposed to, where they lived when they were recruited in 2005 to 10, to their lung function when they were recruited. We found that there was 4 or 5 microgram per meter cubed increase of small particulates, fine particulates. We saw a loss in lung function that was about equivalent to 2 years natural aging. And we were finding that the risks for deprivation, if you were deprived versus not deprived, the deprived groups had twice the size of the effect. And that's a bit breathtaking as well. And it's something that needs further follow-up, because we did what we call a cross-sectional association. We will be doing some long-term follow-up studies of these people, but you do need to wait around 10 years, ideally, to look at lung function in individuals to be able to be clear what the pattern is that you're seeing, what the pattern of decline is. So it is a long-term game. But one of the other interesting things I've been able to do with the study is work with the genetic epidemiologists at Leicester. And we're looking now at whether people's genes influence how they're reacting to the air pollution in terms of the lung function decline. So we're just preparing that paper at the moment, but it's looking quite interesting.
So what are the particular genes that you are... Are you zooming in on particular genes for that one?
Not at the moment. We've done a what we call agnostic study. We've a genome-wide study, and that would be the next step to start pinning down which genes might be affected. I've been trying to recruit for a PhD student to look at that.
So one of the things that's also coming out of your work is that, so showing that if people are living in deprivation, then they are more affected. I suppose it's teasing out. So what are the various factors that are affecting all of this? And this is why these long-term studies are really needed, so that you can gather all of that data to look for the trends, I'm assuming.
Exactly. I mean, you adjust for the important factors that you've got information on. So you'd adjust for smoking level, we adjusted for occupations that might put you at higher risk. You'd adjust or restrict analyses to people who didn't have known disease already, respiratory disease, for example. But what you need to do, I think, as well, is think about what was happening in people's early lives. You know, we know that birth weight's a big determinant of growth. Is that important? If they had lots of respiratory infections as a child, is that important? What's the diet like? You know, it's very difficult to get information on people's diet, particularly at different times of life. And, you know, maybe that's had an influence as well on how their lungs have grown or how they've been able to resist these environmental insults.
OK, so I'm about going to ask a question. Let's get down into what's the nitty-gritty of this? So particulate matter, what's in it? What's it doing to your lungs?
I always think of it like you're walking through soup in the air. You know, when you look out of the corner of your eye on a sunny day and you can see lots of particles in the air? Well, they're the ones you can actually see. There's a lot more that are too small to actually be seen by the human eye. You have to look at them under a microscope. They're a fraction of the diameter of the human hair. And, you know, there's different size fractions that people use for them. So the simplest way is just to, you know, there's acronyms like PM10, PM2.5, ultrafines. It relates to the size of these things. But the PM10 ones can get into the lungs. If they're 10 microns diameter on average or below. If they are PM2.5, so they're 2.5 microns or below, they can get very deeply into the lungs, right down into the small air sacs at the end of the airway passages. If they are what we call ultrafines or nanoparticles, really tiny particles, they can cross over into the bloodstream and circulate around the body. So there's a second part of this. There's also the chemical characteristics of them. So, you know, are they acid or alkali? Have they got sort of sticky diesel, oily stuff on them? Have they got metals that's adhering to that? Has the pollen or fungal spores that are also around in the air, do they stick to these particles? So it gets very complicated thinking about what the particles might actually be doing. But one of the things that most of them seem to do is they set up some inflammation in the lung. So the lung will recognise that these are foreign, and it will set up an inflammatory response to protect your lungs, so that recruits your immune system, and it tries to get rid of them. So you have white blood cells that eat them up. And you have similar processes going on for these things that go around the body. But the very fine ones, you can find them in all sorts of places. So you can find them, they get stuck in placenta, they get stuck in atherosclerosis plaques, which are, you know, sort of fatty deposits on the inside of blood vessels that give you a high risk for heart disease and stroke. It looks quite clear that higher exposures are worse, lower exposures are better, but as low as possible is the best for health.
So alongside this air pollution that you've been looking at, I know you've also been looking at noise pollution, because that also has an impact on our health. So what has your research shown there?
Yeah, I seem to have developed a parallel track on noise. It's not so distant from air pollution, because a lot of the sources are the same. So the noise sources that I've been looking at have been aircraft noise and road noise. But actually, I first got involved when I was working at with noise when I was working at Imperial. And I was the assistant director of the small area health statistics unit. And there was a large study looking at aircraft noise around London's Heathrow Airport in relation to hospital admissions and mortality from heart disease and stroke. And that was a really big study. I mean, we looked at all of London. We looked at the London area that was affected by aircraft noise and a very large area to the west of London. And we found some quite clear associations between higher aircraft noise and heart disease and stroke, both hospital admissions and mortality. It was what we call a small area study, so it wasn't following individuals. It looked at small communities, so it broke up London to lots of small communities. But it was certainly quite a striking effect, and it was published in 2013 in the BMJ, British Medical Journal, at the same time as a study from the States looking at 89 airports in the States, which also found an association with aircraft noise and heart disease. This was called by some of the aircraft industry a game changer, because I think before then it had been very clear that aircraft noise annoyed some people. But this was the first really big study that had made a link with disease and death risk. And we spent a lot of time discussing how the study should be interpreted. You know, we were very careful not to overinterpret it and to say that more studies needed to be done. The World Health Organization published some noise guidelines for Europe in 2018, and they pulled together a number of studies, and they did find evidence for associations from a number of studies, but there's still a lot more that needs to be done on this. So one of the things that we're doing is we're doing a follow-up study to that Heathrow study, but we're looking not just at Heathrow but at other international airports in the UK, looking again at heart disease and stroke, but also using the UK Biobank study. So we can actually look at individuals and control for things like smoking, occupation, deprivation a lot more easily than we can if we just use hospital admission data or mortality statistics. The other thing that we're doing is that we're, as well as looking at the annual average noise levels, we're looking at daily noise levels. So we're trying to see if you're exposed to, you know, noise yesterday, does that affect your heart risk? You know, you're going into hospital with a heart attack today. We've got 5 years' worth of data to be able to do that in the London area, which is it's a huge amount of data. It was about the size. It's a small country, basically, in terms of size. So that gives you a lot of statistical power to try and detect an association. It's also quite an interesting place to study aircraft noise, because the flight paths change according to the wind direction. So about 70% of the time it's from the west, and the rest of the time it's from the other direction. So you've got this natural experiment going on in terms of people's exposure to aircraft noise, and you can use that to help your studies and help the inference of your studies.
You're the director of the Centre for Environmental Health and Sustainability here at the University of Leicester. So tell me about that.
That was an amazing opportunity. So I was approached by the university. They were thinking of setting up a new centre, and started talking to me about whether I might be interested in setting it up. The university wanted to, had a lot of good work going on the environment, and it wanted to try and, enlarge the scope. A really important sort of tipping factor was that Bob Woods, who's a local philanthropist from Mattioli Woods, made a very generous donation to the university, because he has a passion for environmental health. And that was really sort of instrumental in just getting the thing set up. So it started off with me, and then I recruited a colleague from Imperial, who became a professor in exposure science, who I'd been working with for, 15 odd years. And then we quickly moved from, we had two people when we started in 2018, middle of 2018, and we're now up to 18 people, and I hope we'll be 22 by the end of this year. We've concentrated on air pollution and noise, and we're looking to expand into low-level chemical exposures. So we're just starting to do that. sort of chemicals and metals and thinking about their impact. And we've been spending a lot of time writing grants and putting those together. I think we've got 8 noise grants now, and we've got a number of other really important grants. So one of them is a health protection research unit in environmental exposures and health. So it's an NIHR, National Institute of Health, research funded, and we're working in partnership with Public Health England and the Health and Safety Executive. And that started in April 2020, which is, you know, a sort of really interesting time to start up a new national centre. So we've had to work virtually and just be very flexible about timings and getting things together. But we've just done our annual report, and it's been great to see how much we've achieved. We put together our sort of key strategies on this, and thought about, you know, various other really important things like our training and what we call knowledge mobilisation and patient and public engagement with that. And we're focusing on metals. So we're looking at metals in dust inside homes. And then there's a laboratory component because we're looking at how metals can affect bacteria and particularly how they can affect bacterial resistance. Antimicrobial resistance. So that's working with LAMID, sort of infectious disease, with Professor Julie Morrissey, because really interestingly, these low levels of metal can make the bacteria more likely to pick up antimicrobial resistance genes.
I think it's great that Leicester's becoming a centre for this, and I know you're absolutely at the forefront of your field. You're about to become the chair of the UK government's Scientific Advisory Committee on the Medical Effects of Air Pollution. So what is your role going to entail there?
That's a really good question. You know, I think as chair, you maybe have less influence and more influence than you think you have, if that makes sense. So there are certain things that the government will need to know about. So there's really important initiatives going on, the Environment Bill, for example. So the government have been trying to quantify the impacts of air pollution on various health outcomes. But we will need to set a new programme of work, and that will be a discussion with the committee and the secretariat to work out what the priority areas are. I'm very interested in air pollution and asthma, and I think with Ellicacy Debris decision of the coroner, that it's a, you know, it's a good time to think about looking more carefully at this air pollution and asthma link.
So you've already touched on this, as in what the impact of your work is, but what does your research mean for the person on the street?
It's providing information about public health risks and trying to inform public policy. But I'm also trying to get to a point where we can quantify those risks and see how important they are. And for some things, say, actually, this isn't too much of a risk. You don't need to worry about it. Or there isn't evidence at the moment. It's something we might need to keep under review, but it's certainly not a priority area. When I was working at Imperial, there were a couple of large studies. One of them looked at incinerators, municipal waste incinerators, and we found that the with the very modern, well-maintained ones, that the what's coming out of them is incredibly small, and we couldn't find any association with birth weight, for example, or infant mortality. And another study, we were looking at large composting sites. So there's, you know, hundreds of these now around the UK, trying to reduce landfill. And we looked at the respiratory admission rates in the communities living around these sites, and couldn't find any good evidence that there were increased risks in respiratory rates, which is really reassuring.
So you've done a lot of really interesting studies. Have you got a favourite?
My favourite's one of my smallest, actually. I had a visiting research fellowship in Sydney, and they'd done a very interesting study. They had 400 children, and they had followed them up from birth for 5 years to see if they could reduce the risk of allergic disease and asthma. So these were children who were chosen because either their brother or sister had asthma or their parents had it. They randomised these children to either have fish oil supplements or a placebo. So fish, you know, fish consumption has been linked in some studies to, you know, reduce the risk of asthma. So they thought they'd test it in the study. So overall, this study had completed by the time I got there. They hadn't found any clear reduction of asthma with taking fish oil supplements, which is quite useful to know. But what I did with the study was look at allergic disease in relation to traffic density as a marker of traffic air pollution. But we found that the children who became sensitised to house dust mite were the ones who didn't have the fish oil and who were in areas where the traffic density was a lot higher. So it's a really interesting finding, suggesting that the diet and the air pollution exposure might be interacting on your risk of allergic disease. So I think these are the types of studies that are really important to repeat in larger populations. You need to replicate any type of study you do like this. It's you're finding associations. You want to see if you can find them in other, you know, if you want to see if you can repeat your findings, basically. And you know, but these types of real life exposure, people tend to have in the past just looked at, they look at one air pollutant, they look at one health outcome. And nobody lives like that. You know, you're exposed to lots of things at the same time, and you've got a stressful life, and you've got, you know, work, some sort of work exposure going on. And somehow all of that affects your risk of disease. And it's trying to unpick which of those factors might be the most important, and can you intervene, and is that enough to stop you getting the disease or stop you getting it quite as severely?
I think that's one of the things that's really coming across is just how crucial it is to have these long-term, large studies that you're carrying out. So what's next for you?
So we've got some PhD studentships that are looking, using this long-running study looking at air pollution in pregnancy and early life. I've got some studies that are now looking at air pollution and COVID. So I'm looking, trying to look not just at the risk, but also the recovery. So there's a PhD student who's starting in the autumn who will start looking at some of the environmental exposures and how they might relate to severity of disease, but also recovery. And I'm working with several of the clinicians in Leicester to look at what these environmental exposures mean to patients. So there's another PhD student who's looking at mould exposure in asthma, because I remember when I was working in hospital, patients would come in and say, my house is mouldy, it's making my chest worse, doctor. And you didn't know what to do, because you're a doctor, you can prescribe them drugs, but you can't sort the house out. And the consultant, Professor Siddiqui, has had patients come in and say the same thing. They've said, my house was mouldy, I moved, my asthma's got a lot better. And that's something that really needs more study, because if it is important, that could, you know, reduce people's symptoms. It might mean that they don't have to be on expensive drugs for asthma, biologics for treatment for asthma. And there's another study that's just starting up that's being funded by the European Space Agency. That's called P-STEP. You know, it's prescribed exercise. So GPs are prescribing exercise for patients. We don't know how much people stick to it. We don't know what sort of routes are optimal. You know, what's the best sort of way to get people to stick to exercising. So this is a really big multidisciplinary study led by one of the cardiologists, and it's developing an app to just help GPs and patients with prescribed exercise. And where the Centre for Environmental Health and Sustainability comes in is that we are looking at routes with lower air pollution exposure and higher green space exposure to try and maximise the benefits of the exercise. And we plan to be doing some measurements of that to look at the benefits, because there's one or two studies that are suggesting if you've already got heart disease or lung disease and you go out to exercise is good for you, but if you do it in a polluted area, it might offset some of these impacts of the beneficial part of the exercise. So we need some more data on that, because obviously that's really important to know, you know, how much is it potentially affecting the benefit people are getting from exercise.
You're doing loads of really, really interesting studies. I now feel like I want to go out for a walk somewhere quiet in the countryside for a little bit. Thank you so much for talking to me about your hugely important work.
Thank you. No, it's been a pleasure.
Citizen Sounds, University of Leicester. Visit le.ac.uk.